Welcome to The Wicket.
Hello and welcome to another session of Cricket Chat from Arab News here at The Wicket. I'm Brian Murgatroyd, and with me as ever to review the latest happenings in the sport, locally in the Gulf, regionally in Asia and worldwide, are Arab News columnist John Pike and Arab News cricket reporter Subhash Hamagain. Hello, gentlemen.
Hello, Brian. Hello, Subhash.
Hi, Brian. Hi, John.
And in this episode, John and Subhash give us their first-hand reflections of a fantastic Asian Cricket Council Premier Cup in Oman, where the UAE and nine other sides did battle, the UAE securing the victory in the end, and they're heading to the next Asia Cup. We talk Indian Premier League as the group stage of the tournament moves past the halfway stage. We discuss two women's international series, wrapping up Sri Lanka's tour of South Africa and discussing the West Indies' visit to Pakistan. With the Women's T20 World Cup qualifier in the UAE about to start, we assess where the 10 teams taking part are in terms of their readiness. We look at the Pakistan-New Zealand Men's 2020 International Series as both sides continue their preparations for the ICC T20 World Cup on the horizon. And that event, of course, takes place in the Caribbean and the USA. And Subhash and John give us their personal highlights from the past week. So, as ever, plenty to talk about. Let's get started. Let's begin by wrapping up that Asian Cricket Council Premier Cup that took place in Oman. It was a men's tournament featuring 10 teams playing in 2020 internationals: Bahrain, Cambodia, Hong Kong, Kuwait, Malaysia, Nepal, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, the United Arab Emirates, and the hosts, with the winner going forward to next year's Asia Cup, which features the region's heavy hitters. That's Bangladesh, India, Pakistan, Sri Lanka, and Afghanistan. It was won by the UAE, a team that has gone through its fair share of challenges and setbacks in the recent past, but just when it had to, Mohammad Wasim's side found its best form. After losing badly to Oman in the group stages, the UAE still managed to reach the semi-finals as the runner-up in its group. And at that point, it really hit top gear, comfortably beating old rivals Nepal in the semi-final before an equally convincing win over the hosts in the final. Captain Wasim was the star, thumping 100 in 56 balls in that ultimate match to set the platform for the title before experienced seam bowler Junaid Siddiqui took three wickets in his first two overs to kick the stool out from below Oman's run chase. Wasim was named as player of the tournament for 269 runs, and he really led from the front. But it was truly a team effort, with the UAE having the top three run scorers, as Alishan Sharafu and Asif Khan also excelled, while left-arm spinner Ayan Afzal Khan took 10 wickets, making him the second highest wicket taker. Subhash, did you see this result coming, especially after the UAE were trounced by Oman by 9 wickets in the group stage?
Yeah, I think this was coming because the group stage match was affected by rain. And if you see how UAE have performed throughout the tournament, they're getting better match by match. The batter sorted out and the bowling lineup was a bit unstable, but they got there all of the group stage to see which bowling attack favors the best. And I think the last match against Cambodia, they got their second seamer ready in Omid Rehman, and he was perfect in getting that partnership with Junaid. So I think UAE were going favourites into the final, and the right result was they won the tournament.
John, Oman were unbeaten heading into that final. What went wrong for them, and can they take any positives from this failure?
Well, it's well known, and we've commented on it before, that they've been an ageing team for some years now, and maybe this match was a step too far. Now, we know T20 cricket performances between evenly matched teams can vary so much. I don't think they take many positives from that match. The UAE batters reigned supreme, and the bowlers turned the screw for what was a comprehensive victory.
Subhash, just talk us through Nepal's campaign and why it went so badly wrong. Finishing fourth has to be considered a massive letdown for this group of players, doesn't it? And Dipendra Singh, Aries, six sixes in an over against Qatar seems a lifetime ago now, doesn't it?
I think the play, especially the batters, didn't stand up to the occasion. They were fearful of playing the big shots in the power play. I think that's why we didn't get good partnership up top, and that continued the middle order as well. So Dipendra Singh Aries' successes was a huge positive side. They could have ride with it. The team, whole team's morale was up after that game, but they just didn't play like they used to previously. So I think the batters need to take the responsibility of this failure, and I think it's the right time to get the failure, because in the World Cup we should be coming back harder than this.
Well, let's see if Nepal learn lessons leading into that T20 World Cup in the US and the Caribbean. John, let's talk Saudi Arabia too. We discussed their failure to make the Final Four in our previous podcast, and it was no surprise given their inexperience in this company. But what can they take from this tournament, and what is needed to make them even more competitive moving forward, do you think?
It was so close, and I think that's a measure of the progress that's being made. At the end, it was all rather frustrating. People are now alive to the progress. The management's aware of increased expectations and attention. There's a general expectation, I think, that Saudi cricket will take off because finance is available, given the huge investment they've seen in other sports. I think this is mistaken. Saudi players are still part-time, the facilities are limited, still no grass pitches, the team's dispersed across the regions. I think that all needs to be put into place before we can see any massive improvement. And the basic level in this tournament, and the fielding really does need to improve, and it let them down very early on in the first match, which is a very disappointing result.
Sebash, there was a rumour that the number of teams going to the Asia Cup would be raised from 1 to 3. Is there any substance to this, do you think?
Well, the rumour is because they did the same for the women's game. And since this is a T20 format, there's a chance if the broadcasters want that, that could happen, because a lot of funds of the tournament is based on how many times India and Pakistan play. That was the same case in the previous one as well. Even with six teams, they had India and Pakistan facing each other multiple times. So they could raise the game teams from 6 to 8. But since there is no Nepal, Nepalese fans will have a hard time to deal with that situation. But I think ACC would do the right thing and get 8 teams on board, because it's about growing the game, what ACC has been doing in the past. And since they did the same in the women's game, I think that's a huge possibility.
John, as a final comment, can you give us your thoughts on the tournament as a whole, the venues, the organisation and the quality of cricket? Was it a good advertisement for associate cricket in the region and for Oman cricket too, do you think?
Yes, I do think it was a good advertisement for associate cricket in the region. Just following on what Sebash has said, it's puzzled me as to why only the winning team progresses to the Asia Cup. Surely 3 would be good to make an 8-team tournament. As for Oman, the venue is outside of Muscat, about 25-minute drive, has 2 turf pitches, grass outfields, which dried very quickly. The main building houses dressing rooms, the academy, well, I think it's 6 lanes of nets, offices, balcony viewing facilities for dignitaries and guests. And they did assemble a spectator stand, I think, for the World Cup qualifiers in 2022. House of broadcasting and press facilities. Unfortunately, those press facilities were not fit for occupation, and we were housed in the medical tent between the two turfs. And I think a shout out should go to the curator and the ground staff, who coped magnificently with some adverse weather conditions.
I'm glad it was a successful tournament, a thoroughly enjoyable tournament to watch on from afar. And for Oman and Nepal, it's now time to turn their focus to the upcoming ICC T20 World Cup, as both sides have earned places at that mega event. Oman have been placed in Group B alongside England, Australia, Namibia and Scotland, while Nepal will feature in Group D with South Africa, Sri Lanka, the Netherlands and Bangladesh. But of course, the UAE, the winners of this tournament, they're the ones who are going to go forward to the Asia Cup in 2025. It's time now to talk India Premier League, and we're more than halfway through the group stage of the competition. As we record this episode, the Rajasthan Royals have cemented their place at the head of affairs by winning for the 7th time in 8 starts, crushing Mumbai Indians by 9 wickets. With 8 balls to spare, there was 5 for 18 for Rajasthan seamer Sandeep Sharma, while leg spinner Yuzvendra Chahal became the first bowler to reach 200 IPL wickets. Kolkata Knight Riders, Sunrisers Hyderabad and Lucknow Super Giants make up the all-important top four, with the latter finding their way into that elite company after beating Chennai Super Kings for a second consecutive match in a superb run chase thanks to a Marcus Stoinis 100, his first in the IPL, with Chennai now just outside the playoff places as a result of that defeat. Mumbai is still struggling, as are Delhi Capitals, who conceded 266 against Sunrisers, a side that has astonishingly topped 250 three times already in this tournament. Last year's losing finalists, Gujarat Titans, are 2 points outside the top four, but are still searching for consecutive wins this season, while Punjab, with Sam Curran now as captain in place of Shikhar Dhawan, have lost four matches in a row, and Royal Challengers Bengaluru suffered an agonising one-run loss to Kolkata. They remain rooted to the foot of the table with one win from their first eight matches. John, let's start with Rajasthan, and another piece of their jigsaw has clicked into place with 100 for the previously out-of-form Yashasvi Jaiswal in an overwhelming win against Mumbai. Last season, 16 points was enough for a top-four finish, and they have 14 already. Do you think they have one foot or maybe even more than one foot in the playoffs already? And what are they doing right that maybe other sides can pick up on?
Yes, I think they've got more than one foot in the playoffs. And it's probably a bit too late for any lessons for others. The Royals have all-round strength with players who are performing probably near their peak. The openers are a bit in and out, and I think there's more to come from them. But Samson at threes played a different role, a more mature role at three this year rather than float. Pirag's been consistent and settled at four. We've got Hetmyer and Powell doing some effective heavy hitting in the middle. The bowling's varied and incisive with Trent Bolt and Sandeep Sharma, of course, plus the skills of Ashwin and Chahal.
But Sebastian, another week, another Sunrisers batting masterclass, this time against Delhi. And this time it was Shabazz Ahmed, who you will have seen in last year's Asian Games, and the uncapped Abhishek Sharma with an incredible 46 from 12 balls at the top of the order. They were the ones who did much of the damage in this latest batting blitzkrieg. Amazing stuff again from the Sunrisers, isn't it?
Yeah, it's surprising how they do it every single time. They've broken the records multiple times already. They've bettered their own records. And the batting never seems to stop. You imagine that how Head and Abhishek Sharma are playing at the start. You expect them to fail at some times and hope that someone like Aidan Markram needs to produce his pragmatic approach to what Sunrisers are playing. But they're never needed. You know, Markram is hitting balls like he never did. And you have Shahbaz Ahmed, Abdul Samad, who is rated hugely. He's not required at all. So I think they're in dreamland at the moment. And Pat Cummins, he has unlocked his another feature in the game. Nobody rated him as a T20 player, but looks like with mass injury, he might be leading Australia in the West Indies as well.
The Knight Riders very nearly lost against RCB after Mitchell Starc was savaged again. He has struggled a little bit, it has to be said, in this tournament. He did hold his nerve at the back end of that innings. But if you were an Australian selector, would you be worried at the struggles he's going through? In his first seven matches, he's taken six wickets at an eye-watering 11.48 runs per over.
Well, I feel Starc has not been performing well, but it's about how much effort he puts in as well. I think he's still saving up for Australia, but I wouldn't be worried if he's going for runs or he's not getting any wickets. It's about how fit he is going to be for the World Cup rather than his performance, because we've seen him playing at his best for international series, and I think IPL performance will not do much hamper for him, because it's not about the selection pressure or anything. It's just about how he plays the condition, different conditions, how he plays against the oppositions. Yes, a bit concerned, but not worried.
And that match, Sebash, saw a little bit of controversy as well, didn't it, with Virat Kohli dismissed by a high full toss that he thought was over waist height. But it was ruled as fair, as although it was above his waist when he played the ball, he'd come down the pitch, and it was ruled that it would have been below his waist had he stayed in his original stance. What did you make of all that?
The use of technology has had two sides. Some are on the receiving end are unhappy. If the results go their way, they're happy. But the noble call, I think it was a tough one, because you can't judge the ball's deviation or measurement just with the technology. Kohli was on the receiving end, hence was unhappy. But the use of technology, especially in the whites as well, the batters, if they start their stance in the off stump, I think there has been mixed results from the umpires too. So I think it should be equal for everyone. We've seen in Marcus Stoinis' innings, he had two balls wide called against him because his stance towards the offside. So I think there should be a fair result to everyone and not looking at the individuals or teams.
Yes, I think you make a good point there, Sebash. It swings and roundabouts, and over the course of a whole IPL season, you're going to get as many good decisions as poor ones or questionable ones, certainly. John, after Lucknow's chase against Chennai, should we be considering their credentials as possible champions? After all, they've got Quinton de Kock, Kale Rahul and Nicholas Puran in their lineup, as well as 100-maker Stoinis, who's brilliant, unbeaten 124 from only 63 balls, trumped Ruturaj Gaikwad's 108 not out from 60 balls in that match for CSK.
They certainly seem to be on an upward curve. It's an astonishing knock from Stoinis. He took, 15 off the 19th over, bowled by Pathirana, leaving 17 from the last over, and really only needed four balls, 6, 4, 4, no ball, 4. Quite astonishing, and put into significance Gaikwad's earlier classy century. It really quite put that in the shade. I should say, though, that Stoinis did concede 49 of his four overs. The other thing to mention is that CSK are looking a bit vulnerable. You know, 1-4, lost 4 now, so I think it's going to be pretty tight for that fourth spot. They're going to have to do something, I think, pretty strong to put themselves back on the right track.
Subhash, after their defeat to Rajasthan, is it possible to write off Mumbai for this season, or is it still too early to do that? That loss was their fifth in 8 games, and they're 4 points outside the top 4 now, which looks a significant gap to try and bridge.
I think it's tough for them, not just inside the field, the thing outside the field as well. It's affecting the performance of the players, and we've seen that. And with Tim David, Karen Pollard involved in that third umpire fiasco, I think the problem never ends for them. Inside the field, they're getting that performance, but until and unless you have a happy dressing room with the players fighting for each other, I think it's tough to get the results consistently, and that's what's happening in the Mumbai camp.
Well, you called it before the tournament started, Sebash, and all the chickens that you called out on that occasion are coming home to roost with Mumbai at this stage, but there's still a fair amount of water to go under the bridge in the group stage, so let's see if they can get their act together. John, similar question, I suppose, to you on Punjab Kings and Delhi. Jake Fraser-McGurk clicked again for the latter against Sunrisers, but it's been slim pickings for both of them, hasn't it, thus far?
It certainly has. Is it too early to write them off? As you say, there's still water to go under the bridge, but the teams at the top are playing much better. And as I mentioned before, it's going to be extremely tight, I think, for that fourth place in particular.
Well, as ever, plenty to talk about with the IPL. And as things continue in this group stage, we'll do it all again next time here at The Wicket. The Sri Lanka women's tour of South Africa has wrapped up since our last episode, and what a match there to signal the end of the one-day international series. South Africa scored 301 for 5, with captain Laura Wolfhart scoring an unbeaten 184 from just 147 balls, only for that innings to be trumped by her opposite number, Chamari Attapattu, who made 195 not out from 139 deliveries to see Sri Lanka home with a scarcely believable 5.5 overs to spare. That win for Sri Lanka tied the one-day international series at 1-1 after match one was washed out. And remember, the touring side won the T20I series 2-1. Sebash, first of all, let's talk Chamari. She's gone back to the top of the women's one-day international batting rankings thanks to that incredible innings. We were critical of her in the previous podcast for her ambiguous social media post about the possibility of retirement, coming as it did with the side on tour and also preparing for the T20 World Cup qualifier. But I guess an innings like this is a case of action speaking far, far louder than any posts, wasn't it?
Yeah, indeed. I think she was out of this world. She's proven it time and again. And the innings was match-winning innings under a huge pressure situation. And we should give credits to Silva as well. I think she just had 3 boundaries throughout her innings of 50 runs. And she gave strike as much as possible, saving a wicket because she knew the lower horizon offering much. So I think it's a good teamwork there. And Samari, I think, has been stand out throughout the career. And I think at the end of her career, I think one World Cup spot is what she requires. And once they're into the World Cup, they can get back to their old song and perform. So I think it's a good time to get that innings.
And John, Laura Volvart's stupendous effort was put in the shade by Chamari Attapattu, and she must be bitterly upset that her side didn't back her up by winning the match. Should she be upset or maybe merely philosophical because that's what Chamari can do?
Well, having scored 62% of runs off the bat, I think she'd be extremely disappointed. Chamari scored 69% of runs off the bat for Sri Lanka. And notably, South Africa bowled 19 wides. And that's something to be, I think, even more disappointed about. They dropped Chamari twice, I think, and they're also pretty scrappy in the field. It looks like Chamari might have received a bit more support from her teammates than Laura did. But what a masterclass in batting it must have been. And only the second time Sri Lanka have won an ODI in South Africa, coupled with the highest successful chase.
Yes, quite a match indeed. And John, I wonder where you think this tour leaves both sides in the grand scheme of things. Sri Lanka's win was vital to keep alive their hopes of a top six finish in the Women's Championship, wasn't it?
It certainly was. As we know, each team will play 8 3-match series, 4 at home and 4 away over this cycle. Currently, Australia, unsurprisingly, are top. South Africa is second, with England breathing down their neck. And England play Pakistan this May. It may become a little clearer after that. Sri Lanka, what, eighth? Behind Pakistan, who played 21 matches and equal now with the West Indies, 14 points. So you would think that Australia, South Africa, England would qualify, probably New Zealand, leaving Pakistan and Sri Lanka, West Indies, Bangladesh to scrap it out for the final slot. And it's beginning to shape up, I think, to be one of either Sri Lanka or the West Indies.
Absolutely. And just to reiterate what John's saying there, this ICC Women's Championship is the qualifying method for next year's ICC Women's World Cup in India. 10 teams are battling for 6 spots, with the 4 sides below the line facing the prospect of playing in the qualifier. As we record this episode, the order is Australia, South Africa, England, New Zealand, Pakistan, India, Sri Lanka, who've now gone ahead of Bangladesh, West Indies and Ireland. India will qualify automatically as hosts and have also played fewer matches than any other team, while the West Indies have matches in hand on those sides above them, and we'll talk about them next. Here at The Wicket. The West Indies have won their one-day international series against Pakistan in Karachi 3-0 and have given themselves a chance of a top six finish in that women's championship. They crushed the hosts in match one by 113 runs as captain Hayley Matthews produced a superb all-round performance, scoring an unbeaten 140 out of her side's 269 before taking 3 for 17 with her off-spin in Pakistan's reply. Match two was far closer, and the West Indies almost messed up an apparently straightforward chase, eventually sinking home by 2 wickets off the final ball. There were 50s for former captain Stephanie Taylor and Shemaine Campbell, and also 4 wickets for Nida Dar of Pakistan, who became only the second Pakistan woman after Sana Mir to reach 100 one-day international wickets. Match three, well, that was another exhibition of excellence by Hayley Matthews, as this time she made 141 and then took 2 for 26, as her side won by 88 runs. The series win means the West Indies are now just 1 point away from the top six, 2 points back from Pakistan, who've played 5 matches more, and they have games in hand on all those around them except World Cup hosts India, who are already guaranteed a spot at the tournament. John, we said before the series began how vital it was for the West Indies in the Women's Championship, and they seem to have ensured their destiny is now very much in their own hands in terms of direct qualification.
Yes, and as we mentioned, they have games in hand on Sri Lanka, and I think it's likely to be between that pair for that final slot.
And what about Hayley Matthews' excellence, John? She made 325 runs in the 3-match series and also took 6 wickets. What an incredible display. We saw signs of this sort of excellence, I guess, against Australia last October in consecutive 2020 internationals, when she scored 99 not out, 132 in an incredible chase at North Sydney Oval and 79 And this was exceptional form too, wasn't it, as she moved past 2,000 runs in the one-day international format.
Yes, quite outstanding performance. The West Indies will be hoping she can keep that up in the push for that top six place.
Absolutely. Sabash, are you surprised at Pakistan's defeat in this series? That's now one win in their past eight matches. Should they be looking over their shoulders at being ousted from that top six?
I think this result means they're ousted from the top six at home against the team below them. I think they should have won at least two, but getting trounced 3-0 and all to the excellence of Haley Matthews. I think Pakistan are all done. And West Indies has easier matches, Sri Lanka, Bangladesh, who are below them. So I think it's West Indies is going to pick Pakistan over, and Pakistan have a tough series to England. So I think that's all but done, and they'll need to focus on the qualifiers next.
Well, that's a stark message there from Sabash to Pakistan. They'll be hoping it's not quite as stark as that, I'm sure. But the two sides, West Indies and Pakistan for now, are set on a five-match 2020 international series as both look to prepare for the T20 World Cup later this year in Bangladesh. And we'll chat about that next time here at The Wicket. Well, as we release this podcast, the Women's T20 World Cup qualifier in the UAE is getting underway. It's a 10-team event staged in Abu Dhabi across two venues, with Ireland, the Netherlands, Scotland, Sri Lanka, Thailand, Uganda, the UAE, the USA, Vanuatu, and Zimbabwe taking part. Two sides will go forward to the T20 World Cup in Bangladesh. The teams have been divided into two groups of five, with Group A made up of Scotland, Sri Lanka, Thailand, Uganda, and the USA, while Group B features Ireland, the Netherlands, the UAE, Vanuatu, and Zimbabwe. We previewed the tournament in detail in our last episode, so if you haven't heard that chat yet, then please head there once you've finished with this episode. But since that recording, there have been a few things happening that merit our attention. There was torrential rain in the UAE last week, which washed out a quadrangular series between Scotland, the Netherlands, the USA, and the UAE, cutting into those sides' preparation plans. John, how much will that affect those four sides, do you think, limiting their on-field time ahead of the main event?
Oh, quite a bit, I would imagine. They'd want to be playing rather than netting, and they might be finding a bit of match rustiness. You could say it's the same for all of them. But one player who will be feeling it probably more than most is Rachel Slater of Scotland. After a year of injuries and voluntary break from cricket, the left-arm bowler would have been hoping for some match practice.
I'm sure she would, but she didn't get any in that four-way series because of the heavy rain, which really was incredible. They had a year's worth of rain in the UAE over the course of just 24 hours. The USA, though, they did get a couple of matches in against the UAE and Zimbabwe subsequent to that downpour, but they lost them both, while Scotland thrashed Ireland by 8 wickets, chasing down 99 with 3.5 overs to spare. John, you spoke about Scotland in the previous episode. Well, they really look in good order, don't they?
Yeah, they do. The Bryce sisters will be key. Plus 20 years old Ailsa Lister wants to look out for. They did manage two warm-up matches against Ireland, as you mentioned, and Zimbabwe, winning both by 8 wickets and by 32 runs. So they'll be in good heart for a stiff challenge ahead.
Zimbabwe, for their part, they've appointed former West Indies men's fast bowling great Courtney Walsh as a consultant coach for the tournament. He's previously worked with the West Indies women's team. Sabash, can he make a difference for Zimbabwe, do you think? Their results in the recent past against Ireland and Papua New Guinea at home have been extremely modest. How much can he do in a short space of time? What do you think his role is going to be?
Certainly the short time means he'll not be able to help in the skill side of the things, but I think he'll be great help setting the mindset of the players, because he's worked as a player, as a coach, he's been doing wonders. So I think they'll be looking to use his resources in mental aspect of things, how to prepare themselves in such big tournament of big pressure, because it's about going to the World Cup and they have the skills in the side. They've been competitive in previous series. It's just the result they're not getting. And I think he'll be able to help in that side of things.
Well, in the next episode, we'll reflect on the first three rounds of group matches, by which time we should have a very good idea of which teams have put themselves in prime position to reach the semi-finals and which ones have it all to do. One other US news line for you too, albeit involving the men's team. Stuart Law, the former Australia batter, has been appointed as the USA men's head coach. The player, who featured in Australia's 1996 Cricket World Cup campaign as they finished as runners-up to Sri Lanka, has previously worked with Afghanistan, the West Indies, Bangladesh, Sri Lanka and English County Middlesex. Subhash, he steps in after a long period in which the USA haven't had a permanent appointment after J. Arun Kumar left in December 2022. Is this a good appointment, do you think, from your perspective, especially with the T20 World Cup so close at hand?
I think his CV speaks for himself. He's a great coach. I was recently in the Bangladesh Under-19 setup as well. USA are lucky to have him as a coach, but I think he has a big job in his hands with the new players coming in, especially players like Corey Anderson, who's been drafted into the squad. They just played a series in Canada, which he was as a spectator because of his paperwork not being sorted. But I think it's a big pressure for him ahead of such big World Cup, the home team. He'll need to get new players in, get into the group. A big challenge ahead, and I hope the USA will have him for a long time with the recent problem in the administration and all. I hope the players, they'll be able to sort things inside the pitch and give Stuart a good time.
Yes, it's all about giving him an opportunity to get his feet under the table, but certainly in the short term, he hasn't got much chance to do that because the World Cup is coming up very quickly on the horizon with their opening match against Canada at the beginning of June. Pakistan are hosting New Zealand's men's side as the two teams prepare for this year's T20 World Cup. And as we record this episode, a five-match T20 series is locked at one apiece, with the first match ruined by rain. Pakistan steamrolled an inexperienced New Zealand side in the first match as the pace trio of Nazim Shah, Shaheen Shah Afridi and Mohammad Amir shared six wickets between them to help roll over the visitors for just 90. But New Zealand learned their lessons in the next match as Mark Chapman, who had previously proved a thorn in the Pakistan side, again came to the fore to smash 87 not out from just 42 balls to carry his side to a seven-wicket win with 10 balls in hand. Subhash, a new captain for Pakistan, or in this case a returning one with Babar Azam back in charge, but the same frustrations, it seems. There was heavy criticism of the side in that most recent T20I for the scoring rate in the middle overs. And even coach Azam Mahmood said they were 20 runs short afterwards. Will things ever settle, or is this just part of the theatre of Pakistan cricket?
Well, the World Cup is looming and we hardly find Pakistan not being dramatic when such big tournaments come around. And this time it's Babar Azam returning. But I think the problems are not yet sorted. They've got a big player pool to sort out. Usman Khan not being able to utilise his start and the results not going their way. So I think there will be fingers pointed towards each other, especially Babar Azam. He'll need to take the responsibility, get the squad together and prepare for the World Cup. I think this series is more about, even has more pressure because New Zealand are putting their second string side, but there's talents there because T20 side, you never know. So I think Pakistan, especially Babar Azam, should step up and get his squad together now.
Well, Pakistan, John, at least in the short term, have a selection dilemma as Mohammad Rizwan injured a hamstring in the second match and Azam Khan has a calf issue. They've called up Hasibullah as a replacement wicketkeeper batter. And there's also an option of playing Usman Khan, the man originally earmarked not so long ago for a place in the UAE side. He could keep wicket as well. I guess the plus side of all this is it's better to have these injuries now than actually at the T20 World Cup.
Yes, I think Rizwan's the more serious case, isn't he, with a hamstring. And doubts were already being raised as to whether he'll be fit for the start of that. During that match, he did notch up 3,000 T20i runs. And Shaheen posted congratulations on social media, dubbing him the Bradman of T20 cricket, much to the disapproval of some former players. It seems that the Pakistan Cricket Board didn't get around to congratulating them, so Shaheen took it upon himself.
Sebash, I guess for all the negatives of Pakistan, a pace bowling attack of Shaheen Shah Afridi, Nazim Shah, and Mohammad Amir, the latter back from international retirement, looks pretty tasty, doesn't it?
Yeah, if you look at the names and the performance they have had in recent years, it is. But I think still, Shaheen Shah Afridi and Nazim Shah still pick up the ball as the main go-to guys. Mohammad Amir, yes, he's back in the international fold after a long time. But franchise cricket and international cricket are two different things. And he needs to get settled in the dressing room as well. He's a much senior player. If you look at the hindsight, I think Wahab Riaz was supposed to fill in for Mohammad Amir in 2018 is now in the selection panel. So I think that speaks a lot about how big of a comeback it is for Mohammad Amir and how big of a pressure it will be for him to deliver with the Champions Trophy bit. I think he's the guy they should be looking at. There's a huge pressure under him to perform as well.
John, let's talk New Zealand as well. They're missing a host of players on IPL duty, including Daryl Mitchell, Rachin Ravindra, Kane Williamson, Trent Bolt and Matt Henry, all of whom you would assume would be first choices for that T20 World Cup. On the basis that so many of their core is missing, what value are they actually getting out of this series, do you think?
Well, as we discussed before, New Zealand lacks the depth of resources compared with other countries. And this is a chance for less experienced players to get just that. It's a shame that injuries to Adam Milne and Finn Allen come about and that stomach upsets affected Ben Lister and Josh Clarkson for the last game. But as we always said before, how do you get experience? Well, you get it by playing.
At the same time, John, I just wonder, this is a little bit of a sobering situation for Pakistan, isn't it? As I'm sure they would have hoped to have absolutely wiped the floor with a New Zealand team lacking so much experience. And the fact that certainly in match two, they weren't able to do so, that's a real slap in the face, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And I think it may reflect some of the issues that Subhash has just been referring to within the Pakistan camp.
Well, we'll reflect on the T20i series as a whole in our next episode. And finally, gentlemen, as we always do, let's hear from you about something that's caught your attention this week in the world of cricket. John, we'll start with you, if I may.
Yes, apart from Chamari and Laura Vovart, about whom we've already spoken, another batting record has broken in the last few days that stood since 1903. This is Joe Clark and Will Young did this in an unbeaten third wicket partnership of 392 for Notts against Somerset at Taunton. And the previous record was 367 by Billy and John Gunn, an uncle and nephew team. And it's a shame that rain denied Clark and Young a shot at getting up to 400. And indeed, 406 would have been breaking an all-time record for a partnership by Nottinghamshire.
Yes, and Clark's had an incredible start to the season for Nottinghamshire as well, with three first-class hundreds, and there's even talk at this early stage of him possibly having an opportunity to get 1,000 first-class runs before the end of May, which is a really achieved feat, particularly these days, and something, in fact, that hasn't been done in the English county game since Graham Hick did it back in 1988. Do you think he's got a shot at it, John?
Well, we'll see if the weather improves. He needs that on his side, I think.
Yes, the glorious English summer, not. So let's see. He's keeping his fingers crossed for some sunshine, I'm sure. Sebash, what's caught your attention this week?
So the West Indies A squad to come to Nepal ahead of the World Cup was announced, and I was surprised and at the same time excited to see Austin Thomas, Obin McCoy and 13 other West Indies internationals coming to Nepal. I think they would have sent a weakened side, but it's not like that. And some players will be going to West Indies to represent them in the World Cup are coming to Nepal. I was surprised to see the squad at first and equally excited to see them play here at the TU Stadium.
Well, there's going to be some excitement and perhaps a little bit of trepidation from the Nepal batters as well, hearing that bowlers of that pace are heading to Nepal. How do you reckon the Nepal batters are going to get on against that sort of speed? Because they don't face really high pace all that often, do they?
No, I think you don't have any bowlers who goes past 140 in Nepal. And facing, I think, Junaid and Omid in that spell in the semi-final was the turning point of the game. So I think they're going to face West Indies in 5-match series, which will prepare them better for the USA and West Indies leg in the World Cup, I think, to play Mr. Vizur let's say Gerard Coty, probably. So it's a good preparation for them ahead of the World Cup to face players of Ausar Thomas and Oben Mokoi.
Well, that's to look forward to in the near future. But for now, that's all from this episode of The Wicket. Thanks so much for joining us. We'll be back soon with more cricket chat from the Gulf region, Asia, and worldwide. Please don't forget to like, subscribe, and comment on what you've heard wherever you get your podcast. We love to hear your feedback and let us know if there's anything you'd like us to feature in future episodes. For now, though, this is Brian Murgatroyd along with John Pike and Sebastian Hamagain saying thanks so much for listening, and we look forward to your company again next time.
Hey, goodbye.
Goodbye.